Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the SOM TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. Well, the day we've been waiting for, especially me, is here. The fourth SOM film, Cup of Salvation, is available right now for rental and buy on SOM TV. I will have the link for that in the show notes. I hope many of you are already watching it. I cannot wait to hear what all of you think. To celebrate that, I'm going to have one of the main characters, cast member Momotazi from Maysara Winery in the Willamette Valley in Oregon, who has an absolutely staggeringly interesting, harrowing story in wine, on the podcast today. The two of us are going to talk about a number of things, but especially him founding a winery after he fled Iran after the Islamic Revolution in 79. So you'll want to stay tuned for that. I want to remind everybody on SOM TV, we are starting to release hours and hours of bonus features, new documentaries, original content that goes around Cup of Salvation as well. So you're going to want to go to SOM TV where you can watch this conversation that I have with Mo and a lot more in the coming weeks. Without further ado, my conversation with Mo Momotazi. So I'm here with Mo Momotazi of Maysara Winery, one of my absolute favorite wineries in the U.S., let alone in the Willamette. So it's an honest pleasure. I think Mo, aside from being a great human and a great winemaker and a, you know, good father and all the things that go with it, you also have one of the best stories in wine, I think. I mean, truly one of the best stories and one of the wildest stories. We'll take it piece by piece. I want to talk first about Maysara Winery. What does Maysara mean, and how did you start this winery? What was sort of the beginning? We're going to get into all the incredible stuff with Iran and all of that, but how did you start this?
Yeah, Maysara means house of wine in Persian, and we have three words that they describe a winery: Meykhane, Meykhade, and Maysara. Maysara is more of an ancient name for a winery. And in those times, people would go to a winery not to just go and drink and get drunk, but to seek wisdom from the person who poured the wine, whom we call Sarin.
It's a real fancy name for a bartender.
Right.
So that was, it was a religious thing, right? I mean, kind of when you're talking about...
It was. It was just very respected figure in the wine. And this way, he was the one that controlled how much wine a person could consume without getting too intoxicated.
I love it. So House of Wine. So we'll get into a little bit of your history in a sec, but why Oregon? Why did you end up here? Why not Napa? Why not Santa Barbara? Why not Europe?
Given the fact about global warming and all the other issues with climate change, I had the foresight and the wisdom that from the beginning to realize that things are going to be different. And we've been in business the last 23 years, and we've seen considerable change into the climate. And it's just like this area I knew, especially for Pinot Noir, it needs cooler climate weather. And so it was ideal for me to do it here in Willamette. Plus, I had my other business here in Oregon as well. So it just made more sense to do it this way.
Yeah. I think it's obviously you've made this work incredibly well with your Pinot and everything. Just before we get into your story, why Pinot? Did the region dictate Pinot, or were you like, I want to be somewhere where I can make Pinot Noir? Was that your grape?
The majority of our vineyards have been planted to Pinot Noir. We also have some Pinot Blanc and a little bit of Riesling and other varieties. But it's just Pinot Noir. There's only a few places in the world that they produce really great Pinot Noir, given the weather condition. And so it's just like it made more sense than any other varietals.
It's really an incredible honor to ask this question about your Persian history. I mean, because I don't think a lot of Americans, and I don't mean to pigeonhole all Americans, but Americans of born after the year 1980, 1979, I don't think they put enough emphasis on the history of wine and a lot of other things to Iran. Iran has a different cloud over it for especially Americans. Tell me a little bit about the history of wine in Iran and Persia. I know it's a big topic. We could literally have like 14 volumes of books on what I just asked, but from your perspective.
Yeah, in Zoroastrian culture, in ancient Persian culture, wine was considered to be very sacred. And we've been making wine in Iran for thousands of years. And actually, the oldest winemaking vessel was found in northwest of Iran that dates back to 7,500 years ago. And there was considerable amount of knowledge about wine. And wine was also like purifier of the water. And not only that, but also people made a lot of medicine with wine because wine was the thing that preserved, you know, a lot of other plant-like matters into the wine for different kinds of ailments or, you know, physical issues. So that goes back for a long, long time.
Yeah. So we're talking thousands and thousands of years. I mean, obviously Islam comes in, what would that have been, the 600s, 700s? Islam comes and no alcohol, but wine continued to be made throughout that entire period all the way till 1979. And can you tell me before the revolution, before the current regime's revolution in Iran, what was winemaking and what was the wine culture like in, like, say, 1977, 1975, what was that like in Iran?
Well, there were a lot of companies that they made wine. And
on a large scale, like wineries.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, just like love of wine, even after Islam, was embedded in our culture. And of course, you know, in order to not to be punished, because through Islam, as you might know, wine was forbidden, not to the extent that it is nowadays. But, you know, all the poets and philosophers, they talk so much about wine. And in order not to get into trouble, they said they're talking mystically and that they're actually talking about divinity. So that way, you know, Hafez or Khayyam and a lot of other poets, they just pretty much were in love with wine and wine drinking and the culture that comes with the wine.
Yeah. So in the late mid-70s, could you go wine tasting? Were there wineries in different places, Shiraz and the Northwest?
They were. It's just like, of course, it wasn't just like U.S. or some of the other countries that they would have so many tasting rooms and all that, but wine was served almost in every restaurant and every bars. And so it was not a taboo thing. And people really loved drinking wine.
I can't imagine we talk about wine on this, so I'm wine. Wine's the center. The amount of damage that was done to that culture that goes back thousands of years in 79, what happened immediately? Did they rip the vines out? Did they tear down the buildings? What was the immediate effect of the Islamic regime saying?
It was brutal. I actually had some friends that they lived in Urumiye, what is called, it used to be called Rezaye. And some of the farmers that they had a lot of vines, and a lot of them were either Assyrians or Armenians. And their vineyards were attacked, and every vine would be cut off. This farmer guy that had a vineyard, they cut everything except they left one of the vines standing.
Right.
So it was just a lot of punishment for people that they produced wine.
Yeah, yeah. What was, when you were growing up there, what did wine taste like? What was Persian wine like? It's a big question, but I've never had any pre-Islamic. I searched. I can't tell you how hard I've searched. I have not had any pre-Islamic, which I'm sure in Iran there's plenty. There are bottles probably that can be found. I can't go look for them. Not the smartest thing for me to do. What was the wine like? Was it sweeter?
They made both sweet wine and dry wine. And if you study Persian poetry, like Hafez, you know, just like in one of his poetries, he tells the wine pourer, don't bring me that sweet, delicate wine. Bring me the dry wine that's aged 40 years and would knock the socks out of me. but it's just like because of the climate, I think that's the key thing. Not only the climate, but all different varietals of the grapes. And given the fact that the climate is dry, we don't have as much issue with disease and controlling, you know, disease as it is in other countries. It's just like a lot of places, they produce really excellent grapes. Which, you know, the farming is really important to me even today. So when you don't put pesticides and herbicides and things like that and you grow things naturally, it really produces really great grapes and therefore great wines. There are still some, with the help of government secretly, companies that they buy fruit from Iran and then export it to other countries.
Mm-hmm. But not publicly. They don't say it's Persian fruit, right?
Of course. That is true. It's just like, But you could tell because of all the trellis system, things like that. Over there, I lived in a city that because it was extremely cold in the wintertime, it would get to minus 40 degrees. So people just grew the vines on the ground and at a low level. So just like after the harvest, they would put some straw and some plastic on top of that and put like about 5-6 feet of dirt on top of that to preserve it for the next crop because it would get so cold in there. So sometimes the growing condition is really harsh. But, you know, grapevines, their root system goes hundreds of feet down. So some places that starting it would be difficult. But when the root system starts getting deep into the soil, for years and years produced really great vines.
Yeah. It makes me wonder what the Iranian wine industry would be like if the revolution had not happened in 79. Because I think that was right at the moment when wine was starting to become such a global thing. I mean, I hate to bring up the Judgment of Paris, but it's one thing that happened. You know, there's all the critics that started coming and becoming very important. There's also a huge rise in production from France and then investing all over the world. I would be pretty shocked if that revolution had not happened, if there wasn't many, many hundreds of millions of dollars of business happening in the wine business in Iran right now.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. That you know, this current regime has taken us back for hundreds and hundreds of years back, and the same thing with the wine industry as well.
Yeah. So what was your relationship to wine when you were living in Iran growing up? What did you make wine? Did your family make wine? Were you always involved in this? Because right now we're sitting in a beautiful, very large, modern winery that you have built.
Thank you. I was lucky enough that my father made wine. Mm-hmm. Of course, he thought selling wine would be a sin because he thought you should not sell the wine and give it away and share it with friends and family.
Does your father know you're sinning right now?
He's probably turning in his grave knowing that, but I didn't have a choice. Yeah. This big of a property, I have to sell it.
That's funny. So your father made wine, and what kind of wine was it? It was white, red?
He made both, actually. Uh-huh. He made both, and the grapes would come from different areas of Iran. Some what we call Shahani grapes in Persian, which is from city of Shiraz, but also quite a bit from Turkestan, which is close to Qazvin, and Sardasht, that they produce a lot of really good grapes, and some white and some red. So my dad made both.
Okay. And so when the revolution happened, I would assume that stopped, right? Stopped making wine, or maybe you did it secretly?
secretly, and they allowed like some Armenians and some Jews and some Assyrians.
Yeah.
For them, if they consumed that themselves, it was okay. But if they got caught selling it, there would be big punishment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, okay. So let's get into your story. So for Americans that are my age or older, the revolution in Iran in 79 was a very big thing. Obviously, many people have seen like a film called like Argo or something like that, and they have an idea of what happened. But it was a very long, drawn out, very, very dangerous process. And to kind of put perspective on it, how would you describe what happened? How do you sum up what happened during the revolution?
It wasn't supposed to end up like this. And even Khomeini had claimed that when everything would be free and people would be able to do whatever they wanted to in a free society, nobody even imagined things are going to turn out to be as bad. But very slowly, they started changing things. Initially, they would not talk about women having to cover their head or not having certain freedoms. And it's just, but gradually everything started changing, not only in social term, but and cultural term. It's just like they pretty much were trying to force everybody back to 1400 years ago. And it's just really devastating that some of our own people have joined that movement and they completely destroyed our culture and the country. And, you know, one of the richest countries right now is just people are being so poor and so desperate that everybody's willing to change the system.
So how did you get out? How old were you and when?
It was 1982, and the reason that
you were there for two and a half years.
I had gone back in 1978 because of having my degree in engineering. I was able to, in a very short period of time, to rise up and, you know, open up after a few years my own company. Then we did some government projects, but myself and my wife, we used to get stopped so many times and for really doing nothing. It's just like she refused to cover her head. And when we would get stopped, she would argue with the authorities, which it wasn't a good thing. I always asked her to let me do the talking, but she's got such a free spirit that she couldn't take that abuse. Then I would get very upset, and she did realize that one of those times it could be brutal. And because it's just like some of the thugs that they hired, they would, every time they would stop you, point their Kalashnikov toward you and, you know, just really try to scare and intimidate you. And so we did think about escaping because nobody at the time could leave the country freely. And in 1982, it was September of 1982, we escaped and we went through several different countries. And finally, after about 4 or 5 months, we made it to the United States.
Yeah, 4 or 5 months. And I know your wife was pregnant when you did this with your first child. Yeah. You went through quite a bit to get out.
Yeah, she was 8 months pregnant, and the people that they were helping us to get out of the country had promised that leaving Iran would be really easy. But then when we finally got to that city of Zahedan, we were told that the car that was supposed to take us is not there, and we have to get on a motorcycle. And so we were on a motorcycle for 3 days through the mountains, and then for about a week or so with a pickup truck with almost 30 people on a pickup truck, everybody piling up on top of each other. So we finally, after about like 10, 12 days, we made it to Karachi, Pakistan. And from Karachi, we went to Spain, from Spain back to Italy, back to Spain again, and then to Mexico, and we finally came to the United States in 1983.
Now that I look at, you know, what you have with your family, I mean, this is, you've been able to maintain a cultural identity. Not only is it named Maysara, but a lot of your wines are named Persian and Farsi, and older versions of those names. And it's really beautiful to see you be able to hold on to your culture and yet do what you've done. I mean, it's, for me, look, it's one of the great immigrant stories we could have. I mean, if there's anybody you want to come to America, it's somebody like you who builds a business like this and does so much good. It's an incredible thing. And I hope people listening understand how lucky we have it here. You know, that we have not had to do something like what you have had to do just to do what you wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, as we were escaping to, because it was really difficult to have a peace of mind, I kind of always, during that period that we were escaping, would dream that the country that would accept us, I'll do something good in return. And this is my way of returning the favor.
Yeah, good wine. So what do you think are some of the misconceptions Americans have about Iran or Persia? I understand that the current government is the current government, but I mean, what are the misconceptions about the country? Because I just don't think a lot of people think about it outside of that veil that hangs over it.
Yeah, I think the fault is upon the news media because they always wanted to show things that it's kind of odd. And of course, I know there was demonstrations against the United States and all that, but that was all led with the regime and then some followers. But the country and its culture is a very, very kind and great culture. Unlike what a lot of people think, Iranians, majority of Iranians really love Americans and Westerners. They want to become like what you have in here, not going backwards, which it has happened under the current regime. It's just the idea of painting everybody with the same brush. To me, it was really wrong. And so a lot of Americans, they have the misconception that we're a bunch of terrorists. And even up till like a few years ago, anytime you go to the airport and they look at you and your identification, if you had Islamic name, then you would get searched a lot more and put the, you know, terrorist stamp on you.
Right. Yeah, that's something that, again, I don't know if people listening realize how lucky they are to not have to have that as a part of their life. I mean, I don't. I go to the airport, and sometimes I take my shoes off, and sometimes I don't. And that's what it's like for me. So it's a very different scenario. Now, you work, we've been filming Cup of Salvation with you now for quite a long time, and you're a big part, and I cannot wait to talk more about that film. And we'll do that another time. But I now know your family, and you have three of what's the best way to say this? You have three daughters who have a lot of personality. You have a wife who has a lot of personality. And I want to know, what is it like working with your family here? Having your daughter be the winemaker, having your other daughter running the marketing, having another daughter running the facilities and all this. What does that feel like?
Well,
besides exhausting.
In order for them not having any resentment, both myself and my wife, when they were growing up, we did tell them, this is our passion, and you don't have to join and do the same thing. Do whatever you like to do. And I think that was a savior, because it's just like they decided to get to this. And unlike what a lot of people think, that they think, you know, vineyard work and having a winery is a very romantic thing. It is a lot of work, yeah, and a lot of dedication. And I'm just really happy all the girls are very much into it, and they each have a responsibility, and you know, they help each other out, and we all, you know, pitch in wherever there's a need for it. We all pitch in, and we're also very, very fortunate that we have really great employees that they help us throughout the, you know, the whole process. And pretty much we've done everything from the startup ourselves and our employees.
You guys work so hard here. I can't, I mean, I've been here now several times, and there is not, there's not a wasted moment for any of you. You're all doing two or three jobs. It's remarkable to see, especially, this is a big place. You guys have a lot of land, you grow a lot of fruit, and you make a decent amount of wine. That's no small feat.
Well, it's just like the way that we decided to do things. We realize it's not a quick fix, and you have to pay the dues and do things holistically in the right way. And I have also become really fascinated to be like a bridge between the past and present, and try to relearn some of the things that unfortunately we lost, because when Islam came, the order was the Holy Quran is a complete book and we don't need any other book. So a lot of our culture got lost, but a few things that we kept and paid dearly for it. One was our language, our calendar, and the love of wine. So those three have stayed within our culture the last 1,400 years. And as a matter of fact, to resent the system, some people really have, I think love of wine, maybe not so many people kind of act like they're talking about divinity. It's just like a sort of resentment towards certain things that was forced upon us.
Right. So now they love wine and despite them,
right,
kind of thing. Yeah.
Right.
Mo, it is such an incredible pleasure to talk with you. I implore every single person. You guys have one of those wines that has an incredible story, and that alone is why people should try it. But guess what? The wine's really, really good. So even if you don't know any of these stories, you're kind of just like, well, this is an incredible, incredible bottle of wine. So I implore you for all of those reasons to get Maysara wine and drink a lot of it.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure.
Thank you, Mo. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening. It really, really means a lot. I want to tell everyone, you can get the wines from Maysara, which are stupendous. They are truly, truly great wines at maysara.com, M-A-Y-S-A-R-A.com. You should pick those up. Also, go and rent or buy Cup of Salvation. It will be streaming for subscribers on February 23rd, but it's available right now. And on SOM TV, you can watch this episode you just listened to and lots more bonus features that will be coming all through the coming weeks to the streaming date. I want to thank John Adams, our producer, for producing this episode. I truly want to thank Mo and his family for being a part of this. And I want to thank all of you for listening to the podcast and subscribing to SOM TV. Everybody have a great glass of wine and enjoy a great film. Thank you.